Welcome to our second presentation on our introduction to stocks. And in this presentation, we will discuss the primary and the secondary markets, which are just fancy words for where stocks are traded. What is the stock market? What is the exchange? What is the over-the-counter market? That's what we're going to take a look at today. And what we're going to find is that the world is changing at breakneck speed because of the technology. So let's get started on slide number 11. The primary market. The first one? Well, yeah, this is the market in which new securities are sold to the public. We don't usually use the term primary market. Usually what people say is, oh, they're going to go public. It's an IPO, initial public offering. That's the first public sale of a company's stock. And you hear people say, yeah, they're going public, or they're taking their company public. Most retail investors do not participate in the primary market. And in my humble opinion, dear students, it really is not for the vast majority of us in long-term investors. Now, obviously, there are exceptions to this, but no. Most IPOs, as we'll see, lose 50% of their value in the first year. I mean, they go on to do really, really well from that, but there's some reasons why that's true. The secondary market is where securities are traded after they have been issued to the public. And the vast majority of transactions take place here. When people talk about the stock market, they're almost invariably talking about the secondary market. Slide number 12. Why would you go public? Why do corporations issue stock? Well, there are various reasons. They need to raise money to start or expand a business. They got a great idea, but they need $150 million. So they sell themselves to the public and get that cash. To help pay for ongoing business expenses, they've been in business for a while, and now they need to issue more stock. This is the lifeblood for many of the companies based here in San Diego that are in the biotechnology field. They have what is called a cash burn. Right, they're burning through cash. They're not making any money. They have to get that drug approved, and it costs $800 million to get it approved. So they continually go back to the primary market, asking investors to buy their shares and keep the business going. Once the business is large enough, it is the way they gain prestige and respect within the investment and industrial communities, and are rewarded for their labors. Yes, most IPOs, when they go public, make the founding members multi-millionaires, in some cases multi-billionaires, like Farcebook. And also, once a company becomes sufficiently large, it is very difficult for owners to divvy up the spoils without going public. I mean, if you're one of the people who started GE or Coca-Cola or Walmart, how would you sell your share of the business if you didn't have individual shares that many investors could buy them? It would be very difficult. And we ask a question, what are some of the largest private companies? Well, you know one. You ever eat M&M's or Snickers? Yeah, right, that's Mars. It's a private company. But how about Hershey? No. In fact, I think they just got bought. Are they getting bought? I'm not sure. Yes, you can buy Hershey. You can buy Mondelez, which is the spinoff from Kraft that makes snacks and cookies and sweets. But you can't buy Mars. Another large private company is In-N-Out Burger. And for those of you who are interested in business and business case studies, it's a phenomenal case study about what happens when the original people who started the business grow old and eventually die, and then the family is left with running the business, and what bad things can happen, and fights ensue. Yes, it can get ugly, but if they were public, exactly, that would be a different story. Slide number 13. The corporation does not have to repay the money, dear students. This is not a bond. And when you sell shares, it is up to the investor to go find someone, another investor, to purchase their shares when they want to sell. And they may or may not be able to do that. But if it's a bona fide, which is a fancy word of saying a real entity, a real corporation, a real company that's making money, sure, someone's going to want to buy their shares. And the corporation is now a public entity, which, what does that mean? Well, if you go to Mars and say, how much money did you make last year? They'd say, who are you? Are you the IRS? We don't have to tell you how much we made. But a public company must file annual, those are called 10-Ks, and quarterly 10-Qs. 10-Q? You're welcome. They must file these reports with the Securities and Exchange Commission. They must have at least one public meeting annually where shareholders can get up and air their grievances. And SDG&E, Sempra, is an example of that. They made some boneheaded maneuvers about 15-odd years ago or so. And shareholders in San Diego would get up and just yell at them left side, round side up, and just give them hell. And so they said, oh, we'll fix your little wagon. They had their annual meeting in London, okay, one of the most expensive cities in the world. Chapter 5 in the book goes into much detail, in my humble opinion, too much detail, about IPOs. IPOs do not usually live up to their expectations, folks. As we said, the typical IPO loses 50% of its value in 1 year. And Benjamin Graham likes to call them initial public offerings. He likes to call them, it's probably overpriced, or imaginary profits only, or an opportunity for the insiders to make a lot of money, which is what often happens. If it's a hot issue, and that's the name they use, a hot issue, there's a lot of interest from the public, they will overprice it. The public buys it at the overprice, and then these insiders, get filthy rich, and then a year later the price has fallen in half. And that's exactly what happened with Facebook. Now it's come back and done very well, but that insiders profit opportunity. That's what he calls it. I apologize. And Mr. Graham is a very astute observation of the stock market. He was Warren Buffett's teacher, and we'll come back to him later. And you're going to read The Intelligent Investor someday, I think. Yes, you are. Okay, now, slide number 14. We're going to stay away from the IPOs, right? Right? Maybe you'll get involved with those. But no, the secondary market, the stock market. When people refer to the stock market, they're referring to the secondary market. This is where the securities are sold after they have been issued. It's sometimes called the aftermarket. I haven't heard that too often. But the secondary markets provide liquidity, which is a fancy way of saying you can sell your shares or buy more shares. An easy method for transferring ownership of the securities, which would be a difficult problem if the corporation were very large and only held by the family, right? And a convenient mechanism for pricing and valuing your securities. Well, I don't know. How much are these 100 shares of IBM worth? Go out and see what people are paying for them. Now, you might have a different idea of what they're valued at, but the market is where you're going to sell them or buy them, and they're the ones who have the final say. Slide number 15. The types of secondary markets fall into two categories, but let's read the bottom. This is an outdated comparison. Due to technology advancements, mergers, acquisitions, all the stuff that's going on now, the traditional differences between the two have all but been erased. And the changes are just getting started, folks. But as a history lesson, we learn that the organized securities exchanges were centralized locations in which transactions were made in existing outstanding securities. It was done via a face-to-face double auction. What's a double auction? Well, you see, you're used to a single auction where there's one seller and multiple buyers, multiple bidders, and the auctioneer is basically controlling the process. A double auction is where there are buyers and there are sellers all calling out prices at one another all the time. And it looks like mayhem, and you see the videos, but you don't see them anymore because they're gone. You know, there's a few people sitting on the floor of the exchange, but mostly they're standing around for the television cameras. It's all been computerized. And the other type of market was called the over-the-counter market. And some people still do call it the over-the-counter market, but the biggest player in the over-the-counter market is called the NASDAQ, and they hate it when you use the over-the-counter moniker. They don't like you to use that name. They don't want you to use it. They don't want you to associate NASDAQ with the over-the-counter. They are the NASDAQ. And these things were widely scattered telecommunication networks through which transactions were made in outstanding securities, and smaller initial public offerings. And when we say telecommunications 50 years ago, that's what they meant. I mean, it was a telephone. And you would call up Fred in Minneapolis, who you knew dealt in this one company that nobody buys. And you'd say, "Hey, Fred, you want to sell some out?" "Yeah, yeah, how much you charge it?" "25 cents. And he'd slam the phone down. He's like, "Forget it, I'm not paying that much." And so you call him back 10 minutes later, "I'll give you 20 cents. And Fred says, "No way." And he'd slam the phone down. These people, they took lessons in how to be rude to one another. But now that's all changed. It's all online. It's all done computerized. So the differences between these two are been erased. Except that there still are exchange floors. Slide 16. Historically, all trading was conducted on the exchange floor. And they still have the floors open. But as I said, I think it's just for the television. There's very few transactions happening at the exchanges now. You just see people standing around. A few people are making deals, but no. You see, trading was conducted using a double auction. Instead of the one seller, multiple buyers that you see at an estate or a farm auction, right, as we said, there were multiple sellers and multiple buyers. And you can still see videos of these things if you just type in, exchange floor, double auction, or something. I have a video that I show the face-to-face class, and, the company's long since gone out of business, and you can't find anybody, and so I'm talking with the school whether or not we should put it online and risk. I can't find anybody. I've tried yelling at us for copyright protection, but it really shows what's going on and how these people just scream and holler at one another. But both due to the technology and the sheer massive volume of trading, almost all the trading now, as I said, is conducted electronically. There are still some trades done via humans, but they are few and far between. I think eventually they're going to close the exchange floors just because it costs them money to keep them open and nothing's being done there. But I think they keep them open mostly for television. Slide number 17. And who is the granddaddy of them all? The New York Stock Exchange, the NYSE, the big board. Traditionally, it was responsible for over 90% of the volumes of transactions on the exchanges. And, everybody else was small potatoes. These guys were the big boy on the block. That's why they're called the big board. And right now, we're looking at about $20 trillion of market capitalization as of June 2016. In 1792, it was established as a members-only entity, and it remained that way for over 200 years, when Wall Street really was next to a wall. Companies listed on the New York Stock Exchange must meet stringent requirements, and they were traditionally the most prestigious, the largest companies. Companies can become delisted. Kodak, the old Kmart before it went through bankruptcy, if they fail to continue to meet the NYSC, New York Stock Exchange, requirements. In other words, you have to have a certain amount of shares. They have to be worth a certain amount. The price has to be over a certain amount. There have to be a certain number of transactions that occur. And if not, you don't belong on the big board. Go someplace else. Mm-hmm. Very, very, very high scale, upscale, and snobby, the big board was. Not anymore. Slide number 18. Why? Because of the huge changes that are happening in technology. In 2005, they purchased an electronic exchange and the Pacific Regional Exchange. The electronic exchange was called Archipelago. And then in 2006, they stopped being a members-only partnership. By the way, the first woman was not allowed until 1966. And the first person of color wasn't until 92 or so. That's when they merged with Euronext, an electronic exchange from Europe, and they were trying to buy the London exchange, but they couldn't. They've been phasing out. In fact, as I said, it's almost all gone. The double auction face-to-face trading. And in 2011, Germany stock market, the Börse, Börse, based in Frankfurt, tried to buy the New York Stock Exchange. But that was blocked by the European regulators. And then in 2013, the New York Stock Exchange was acquired for $11 billion by a 13-year-old derivatives trading firm from Atlanta, a company that wasn't in existence until the year 2000. They bought the New York Stock Exchange. In 1992, on their 200th birthday, if you had told the folks at the New York Stock Exchange that the next 20, 25 years would see far more changes than in their first 200 years, they probably would have thought you were quite insane. But you would have been right. Slide number 19. The brokers. The people running around in different colored jackets and the like. You don't. They're gone. The house brokers would execute orders on behalf of the firm's customers. Occasionally on behalf of the firm's own account. The independent brokers would run around and work for whoever needed them. They were called the $2 brokers because, yeah, they'd make $2. The floor brokers were very worried that the New York Stock Exchange's aggressive moves to all electronic trading meant the end of their way of life. Well, for some of them it was, but for others, no. It was just a big change from face-to-face interaction to sitting in front of a computer screen all day. Does this sound familiar? You are sitting in front of a computer screen, listening, watching my presentation. I'm sitting in front of a computer screen, giving the presentation, and sometimes we actually see one another if you stop by my virtual office hour. You brave new world! Yeah, everybody's affected by technology. Slide number 20. The specialists, which are basically gone now, but these were people who specialized in making transactions in one or more stocks. The job of the specialist was to manage the auction process. They would buy and sell stock from their own inventory to provide a continuous, fair, and orderly market. Now, what does that mean? If all the buyers disappeared and there were people trying to sell, what's going to happen to the price? It's going to drop like a stone. The specialist's job was to get in there and buy and keep the market open. If everybody who was selling disappeared and there were only buyers, the price would skyrocket. The job of the specialist was to get in there and sell. Their job has essentially been squeezed out by technology and the tremendous volume of trading. They're only involved in a tiny amount of trading each day. In fact, they don't even call them the specialists anymore. Excuse me. They call them designated market makers and supplementary liquidity providers. And they're mostly computers now. From time to time, the specialists were either praised or maligned. Suffice to say that they were trying to make a profit just like everybody else. While their goal may seem altruistic, right, to buy when everyone else is selling and sell when everyone else is buying, they made sure that when the market received benefits from their efforts, so did they. And there was a lot of anger at sometimes. But the reality, folks, is that there were only a few well-publicized cases where specialists were committing hanky-panky. You know, for the most part, they were in there fighting the good fight and doing what they could to make money while keeping the market from falling apart. Slide 21. Now, the American Exchange was the, for decades, the kid on the block. Literally, folks, on the block. I mean, they started on the curb, and that's what people would call them. They call them the curb. They started outside, looking in and seeing what was going on in the New York Stock Exchange, and then they'd trade outside the curb. And if you, just type into any search engine, curb brokers or Amex curb brokers, here's a link for you, but check it out. You'll see that these guys were, they had their own little dress that they would wear. They'd wear their little caps. And it gets cold there in the wintertime. So eventually they got their own building down the street. They were always very, very small compared to New York Stock Exchange. And they saw the writing on the wall over 20 years ago. They started concentrating on securities other than stocks. In fact, remember the ETFs from chapter four, exchange traded funds? They started on the Amex, right? But now they're everywhere. In 1998, the NASDAQ bought the Amex and then sold them 4 years later, kicked them out the door. And then in 2008, the New York Stock Exchange bought them, closed down their building down the street and moved them onto their location and changed the name to NYSE MCT or MKT or I've never heard anybody call it anything other than the Amex, but now its name is New York Stock Exchange MKT, which I guess stands for Market or MCT or MKT. Anyway, bye-bye New American Stock Exchange. Bye-bye Curb. Bye-bye New York. No, it's still in existence. It's small potatoes. Slide 22. And then there were they still are called the regional exchanges. And they, again, were just small potatoes, very, very small entities compared to the New York Stock Exchange. Chicago, Philadelphia, Pacific's a little strange. An exchange is supposed to be a centralized location, but the Pacific Exchange is in Los Angeles and San Francisco, so figure that one out. Boston, Denver, Cincinnati. Denver was the one that was where there was hanky-panky, stock issues that were not always real companies, that were sometimes scams, right? And there has been the urge to merge. The New York Stock Exchange bought the Pacific Exchange. The NASDAQ bought the Philadelphia Exchange. The Philadelphia Exchange is known for its expertise in the world of semiconductors. I don't know why. I mean, they're traded in every exchange, but for some reason people think the Philadelphia Exchange knows about chips. You would think that'd be the Pacific Exchange, but I don't know. But these guys, again, they are very, very small, and they are being subsumed, ingested, devoured by the big players. There are exchanges for those derivatives we briefly mentioned in Chapter 1, the Options Exchange, the Futures Exchange, which is called the Chicago Board of Trade, the Chicago Board Options Exchange. And why did they start in Chicago? Well, it has to do with the fact that Chicago was where much of the goods and that were being produced in the Midwest, that were being sold all over the world, you know, the sausages and the wheat and the corn, they would make their way to Chicago, which became a major international trading hub. And so those places that did do commerce in these items started selling the options and the futures. And we'll discuss those later on. Futures makes sense, folks. There's a reason for futures. Options are basically gambling. But just know that they're sold now everywhere. Everywhere, everywhere. They're not just sold in Chicago. Okay, so those were the exchanges. Now let's take a look at the over-the-counter market. And again, the over-the-counter market is a bit of an anachronism, which means an old-time saying, an archaic saying, because it is all computerized, right? Not people don't pick up the phone now and yell at somebody across the country about what they're going to buy and sell. It's all computerized. It's a quote-based system. Whereas the people in the exchanges were yelling at one another, on the OTC, people would type in, or they'd talk about it, but now they type it in, what they will buy it for and what they will sell it for. Now, there are three tiers. We'll discuss each in a bit. But the NASDAQ is the big boy. And they do not want to be associated with the OTC. They don't even want you to use that name. Just call them the NASDAQ, and they are not associated with these next two. The bulletin board and what used to be called the pink sheets. And why were they called the pink sheets? You can imagine. There'd be a newspaper that came out every day showing the prices, the bid and the ask prices, and they were pink. The newspaper was colored pink. I don't know why, but that's why they called it the pink sheet. But they're trying to clean up their act. They're trying to, at least. If you go to their website, and you'll see that they are really trying to not allow these scam companies. You saw The Wolf of Wall Street, maybe, or you saw Boiler Room. If you didn't, you don't have to, but I'm not asking you to go out and see them. But basically, many of these companies are scams. They're penny stocks. They're not real companies. There's somebody's garage in Idaho or Iowa or some other place that starts with the letter I, and they are not a real corporation, but you will see advertisements in your mailbox, your email box now, if you get involved in investing in any way and get on somebody's email list, for these companies that are making blue steam. This company is coming out with this brand new technology that's going to revolutionize the world. Yes, folks, it's blue steam, and it's a lot better than the bacon stretcher that they came out with last year. That kind of didn't really work. And then the left-handed smoke shifter that will revolutionize it's all pump and dump. It's all trying to get you to buy worthless pieces of paper. Now it's all bits and electronic. And then they dump it and they run and go someplace else. And by the way, it's illegal. And so these places are where those companies lived. And as I said, they're trying their best to clean up their act. And I don't know how well they're doing personally, because I don't follow these companies other than to try to get you to stay away from them. Yeah, this is the wrong side of the tracks, folks. The red light district, the bad side of town. Slide 25. In the over-the-counter tradition, there were not brokers, but dealers, market makers. They were essentially the specialists. There were no brokers. I mean, your broker dealt with these people, but the market makers would offer the stock at an asking price, the retail price, and they would buy it back from you at the bid price, the wholesale price. Now, I want you to remember these. I know it's a little difficult. Ask. I'm asking for it. I'm a retail investor, and I'm asking, what's the price? And the bid is what they will pay you if you come with the stock in hand. And this is what's going on now everywhere, folks, but it's all happening electronically. And the difference in this bid and ask price is called the spread. So please, write these things down, memorize them. The ask, I know it's a little difficult, it's a little tough, but in reality, it makes sense. If you have to ask for it, all right, it's going to cost more. The ask price is always more than the bid price. You're a retail investor, you're going to pay the ask price. You're a retail seller of stocks, you're going to get the bid price. And the dealers make difference by the spread. The dealers, the market makers on the NASDAQ, perform roughly the same role as the specialists did on the New York Stock Exchange. But as we said, it's now basically all this system. Everybody is sitting in front of a terminal, typing in what they will pay for a stock and what they will accept for a stock. That's how it works. Okay. And it should look familiar to some of you. Slide 26. Why? Because you've been to San Ysidro or Tijuana. And when you go down to the border, and in fact, it's not there yet, but it will be, have a little presentation, you will see the casas de cambio. These are the places where you buy and sell pesos and dollars. And you don't see one price. No, you see two prices. The price they will ask you if you want to buy pesos with your dollars. You know, they're going to give you, right now, we'll see. You'll see it's 18 or so. Pesos has gone down quite a bit. And then if you want to give them dollars and they give you pesos, well, it's going to be a little lower, isn't it? Exactly. And so that's how they make their living. And on the ticket, which is not a ticket, it's an email now or whatever the transaction, however you're given your transaction, you don't see the markup or markdown of the dealer. You just see the broker's commission. Ah, you see that? You see, this is how these people make money. How do you think the internet brokers make money on $5 or $7 a trade or $0 a trade? Right, we'll discuss this later on. Right, exactly. And if you go to the Casas de Cambio, you'll see, no comisión, you know, we don't charge you commission. We're dealers, we're market makers. We make money off the difference between what we will sell you the item for and what we will buy it back from you. And if you're into baseball cards or comic books, you know all about this. Because you go to a website and it says, yeah, oh yeah, we're charging $20 for this comic book. And you say, well, I have that comic book. Will you pay me $20? No way. We'll give you $12. That's a huge spread. And sometimes, especially with these lower priced penny stocks, the spreads are enormous. You know, they don't look that big because the prices are 5 cents, but you have to pay 5 cents, but they'll give you 2 cents. That's, you know, more than a 50% spread. You're going to lose your shirt. Slide 27. Okay, finally, we're now going to talk about the NASDAQ. Folks, the NASDAQ was started by the National Association of Securities Dealers. This was the non-governmental organization that used to be responsible for self-regulation of registered representatives. That's a fancy word for stockbrokers. That's the legal word for stockbrokers. And all the brokerage firms. Well, they don't do that anymore. In fact, they don't even want to be known as the NASD, the National Association of Securities Dealers. They just want you to know them by the term NASDAQ. Because NASDAQ actually stands for National Association of Securities Dealers Automated Quotation System, and very few people know that, and they don't even want you to know anymore. So that's just the NASDAQ. It started as the first electronics communication system back way 1971, when people were still calling one another and yelling at one another and slamming the phone down. And now they've gotten really big. You know, we're looking at 2,800 stocks. I forget. Oh, it's on. I think it's on the next slide. Or $11 trillion or so. They used to be the arena for small companies to get started, but once they were large enough, that those companies would move to the New York Stock Exchange. Well, wait a minute. Ever since the 1980s, many prestigious companies decided that, oh, thank you very much, New York Stock Exchange, but we're very happy here on the NASDAQ. And you might have heard of some of these small startups like Apple and Microsoft and Intel and Qualcomm and Costco and Facebook and Google. Yeah, right. Now these companies are as big, in the case of Apple and Google are the two biggest companies in the world. And so, yes, you could hear the two words at the top of the penthouse to the New York Stock Exchange in the boardroom. And the first one was, oh. And the second one was, yeah. So now it's a two-horse race. Before, the New York Stock Exchange used to look down on everybody. Now the NASDAQ is hot on their heels. New York Stock Exchange is still bigger, folks. But, yes, exactly. It's a two-horse race. And they're merging with other, you know, buying up, gobbling up everybody they can. The NASDAQ, slide 28, is a three-tier system. There's the Global Select, the Global Market, the Capital Market. I don't ask you to remember those, folks. You just remember the NASDAQ. Most people don't know that there are three tiers. But they call the Global Select the creme de la creme. In other words, these companies are easily qualified for the New York Stock Exchange. And then the national market now it's called the global market. They're larger companies. And then they have the capital market, which used to be called the small cap market, which are the smaller companies that they allow to stay on the NASDAQ. In the 1990s, this is so cute, you know, they started running ads saying, we're the securities market of the future. A bit of a jab at the New York Stock Exchange, which they say is the New York... Well, they're absolutely right. I mean, the New York Stock Exchange knew it, too. There was no way that they could keep this double auction, face-to-face system going. They knew. They were already moving away from that in the 1990s. But it was just definitely a jab. And as we said, they're roughly about $12 trillion of capitalization. So they're still smaller than the New York Stock Exchange. But yeah, they're nipping at not just nipping at their heels. I mean, they're really duking it out, folks, and they're all trying to buy other companies and trying to get bigger and bigger and bigger. Slide 29. Now, there were a couple of what are called alternative trading systems, and now there are dozens. There was the third market, where these over-the-counter transactions, again, there were market makers, were making markets and securities that were on the New York Stock Exchange, that were on the NASDAQ, and eventually on the IMX, and eventually on the NASDAQ. But they were for big entities like mutual funds, insurance companies, pension plans. Because when you want to buy a million shares... Yeah, you definitely, you know, well, 30, 40 years ago now, a million shares isn't that many for some companies that have 6 billion shares. But when you wanted to buy a large block of shares or sell a large block of shares, you wouldn't necessarily get the best prices on the exchange or the NASDAQ. So you went to these alternative trading systems that allowed dealers, market makers, to get the big boys and girls, the mutual funds, the pension plans, to work together. And it reduced the transaction cost, but it was still facilitated by a dealer. And the famous one in this entity, this area, was the Intermarket, which we see is now owned by the NASDAQ. Aha! And then the fourth market, sometimes called the Electronic Communication Networks, these started in the 80s, but then got really big in the 90s with the internet technology. And they allowed the institutional buyers and sellers to bypass the dealers. They could go directly to one another. Kind of like eBay. A little bit like, if you ever go on eBay, but instead of just one seller, multiple buyers, there were multiple sellers, multiple buyers. These ECNs, as they became known, were privately owned electronic networks that automatically matched buy and sell orders that customers placed electronically and started to get big, and then they started to court the retail customers because they were able to, because of technology. And guess what? Right, the New York Stock Exchange and NASDAQ, notice the archipelago is now owned by the New York Stock Exchange, right? And so, the NASDAQ and the New York Stock Exchange are not going to let these guys get bigger than they are. They're going to turn around and buy them. Now, what's this BATS? This is an interesting entity. It stands for Better Alternative Trading System, I think, is what it stands for. Yeah, BATS, which I don't think is the best term. You have bats in your belfry? I don't know, whatever. But these people are based in Kansas City. They're based in a strip mall in Kansas City. Now think about this, folks. Think about the technology has done. New York was the Mecca. New York was the Jerusalem. New York was the center of the universe for United States financial transactions. But because of the technology, these yo-yos can start up their own alternative trading system in a strip mall in Kansas City. Yeah, that's what we're looking at, folks. Slide 31. All right, so now you're going to go back over and you know, review these things, because I want you to know what they are, because you basically need to know them. Not all the tiny little players, but the big players, the NASDAQ and the New York Stock Exchange. But isn't the stock market all just one big malignant casino, Piano? Aren't they all crooks on Wall Street? Well, the truth is the answer is yes and no. Yes, it is a malignant casino. No, it's not a malignant casino. It all depends on you, dear student, dear potential speculator, trader, or investor. Yes, the stock market is just one big malignant casino. There are many individuals who see the markets as a crapshoot. For them, the way to riches is to buy and sell, buy and sell, and buy and sell. And what do we call them? Speculators. Traders. T-R-A-D-E-R, not traitors like Benedict Arnold. It is very difficult, folks, and you are up against the best in the business. Neophytes become very upset when the market turns against them. But there's an old saying, if you don't know who you are, the stock market is an expensive place to find out. And no, dear students, the stock market is not one big malignant casino. Many others look at the capital markets as a way to participate in the growth and prosperity of the global economy. With a long-term orientation, investors are usually very well rewarded. Yes. That's what I hope you become. And I will take every opportunity to sneak this quote in from Mr. Benjamin Graham. An investment operation is one which, upon thorough analysis, promises safety of principal and an adequate return. Operations not meeting these requirements are speculative. I used that in Chapter 1, if you remember, and I'm going to use it again, because I want you to internalize it. Exactly. I want you to decide, are you a speculator? Am I speculating? Am I trading? Am I trying to make a quick buck? Am I trying to buy it at 10 and sell it at 12 or 20? Or am I deciding I want to become a partner with this company and share in their long-term success? It's your decision. Slide 31. Oh yeah, Piano, what about Enron? Aren't corporations all crooks? Well, how do you answer that? Fraud and accounting trickery and gimmicks have always been with us, and they're always going to be with us. Do you know the famous quote, which is attributed to a bank robber by the name of Willie Sutton? He didn't actually say it, but it was attributed to him. Because that's where the money is. Why do you rob banks, Mr. Sutton? Because that's where the money is. Normally, but not always, these firms that are pulling these shenanigans are regulated to the bulletin board, the pink sheets, now called the OTC markets. But for everyone, Enron and WorldCom and Global Crossing, Adelphia, I could go on, yeah. There are hundreds, no thousands of companies that continue to do business with integrity and honestly, well, maybe it sounds like an ad. Usually they do. Look, it's never going to stop, folks. In 1973, there was a company called Equity Funding. It was a life insurance company, folks. Life insurance companies. It's a license to make money, folks. It's like a bank. How do you know they're making money? Their doors are open. And yet, what did these bozos do? They would go into a room and make up life insurance policies. They just fill them in with phony names. How long was that going to last? Right. The stock took off, and then when people realized that it was a fraud, it burned, crashed and burned. In 1986, Ivan Boesky and Michael Milken and Vagabond Inns, which you may sound familiar because they're actually based here in San Diego, but this bozo, Boesky, was using Vagabond Inns as a front for insider trading. He and Michael Milken, in a company called Drexel, Burnham, and Lambert, were issuing junk bonds, 17% interest on Vagabond Inns, which was far too small to issue bonds, and they were using the proceeds from the bonds to do insider trading. Did you ever see the movie Wall Street? It was based on Michael Milken and Ivan Boesky. In 2002, Enron, Global Crossing, Tyco, Adelphia, WorldCom. In 2008, Fannie, Freddie, Lehman, Citi, WaMu, AIG, and don't forget Bernie Madoff! He ran a Ponzi scheme for 15 years. The moment you engage in a Ponzi scheme, folks, you know you're going to get caught. It's only a matter of time. And usually don't last more than a couple of years. This guy had it running for 15 years. 10, 20 years from now, during the next big bull market craze, somebody else will take their place. Which is why I will reiterate Mr. Graham's quote, issues not that are not, according to this this definition, are speculative. Companies that do not guarantee a prudent return with safety of principle. Yeah, right. So, beware. Slide 33. To recap, securities markets. The securities markets exist to allow investors a safe, cost-effective method to participate in the success of the global economy, and even with all the underhanded shenanigans and trucos and travesuras and hanky-panky, they have performed very well, and they are changing at breakneck speed, and that change is only accelerating. Now, whether or not we ever have one or more global 24-hour trading markets remains to be seen. I don't want that. I mean, 2 a.m., you're going to wake up in the morning and say, I want to buy, sell my shares. But it is exciting and for some scary to watch, especially for those who have a stake in the outcome. So, as I said, you're going to go back and make sure you know the big boys and girls in the arenas here. And in our next presentation, we'll discuss transactions themselves and how stocks are bought and sold. And we will also take a look at the indices. About time, isn't it? It's about time we actually get to start looking at these indices. See you in our next presentation, dear students.